This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, will the U.S. decision to position tanks and arms in Europe deter or provoke more Russian aggression in Ukraine? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Washington is set to pre-position about 250 tanks, along with other heavy weapons and military equipment, in six European countries, including the Baltic states, to reassure NATO allies against threats from Russia and terrorist groups. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, along with Bulgaria, Romania, and Poland, had agreed to accept elements of such equipment, which could be moved around the region for training and military exercises. After Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula last year, NATO leaders agreed to increase military exercises and rotations of forces through NATO allies in Eastern Europe and to store military equipment there for use in case of an emergency. In 1997, NATO promised Russia not to place substantial forces in the new member states, once part of the Kremlin's European empire. But Western officials point out that such a pledge was dependent on relations remaining friendly. And Russia's behavior in Ukraine and its allegedly menacing moves in the Baltics have rendered that pledge void. NATO is also mulling American plans to create a new rapid response force. Such actions affirm the alliance's commitment to mutual self-defense. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter said, quote, "We do not seek a hot war with Russia, but make no mistake, we will defend our allies. We will stand up to Russia's actions and their attempts to reestablish a Soviet-era sphere of influence," unquote. Well, for more on the pros and cons of the U.S. forward deployment in Europe, we turn to two distinguished analysts. William Pomerantz is deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center. That's a think tank based here in Washington. He also teaches Russian law at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University here in Washington. And Jeffrey Mankoff, he's deputy director and fellow with the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a think tank based here in Washington. He's also the author of Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us.
William Pomerantz, let me begin with you. Let's talk about this forward deployment. Are you in favor or against the U.S. decision to position arms and tanks in Eastern and Central Europe? And to what extent do you think this will actually deter or perhaps even embolden Russia?
Well, I think it is a move that was necessary in light of events in Ukraine, that after Russia's annexation of Crimea, after its engagement and incursion in eastern Ukraine, clearly our East European allies felt nervous about Russia's intentions, especially after Russia announced, according to its own kind of philosophical doctrine, it had a right to protect Russian speakers anywhere in the world. And there are significant Russian minorities in at least two of the Baltic states. So there was clearly disquiet and nervousness in response to what had gone on in Ukraine, in Eastern Europe. And therefore, in order to show a commitment to our NATO allies, in order to show that the Article 5 commitment that if attacked, we would come to their defense had real consequences, the U.S. and its NATO allies have decided to make a relatively small deployment. Will this deter Russia? I think we've learned a lot about Mr. Putin, and most things that we think might deter him actually don't, if he believes certain actions are in his interest or in Russia's national interest.
Turning to you, Jeffrey Mankoff, for your position on this forward deployment, are you in favor of it? Do you think it will, in fact, potentially deter Putin, who thinks actually this is a provocation toward him? He doesn't see his actions in Ukraine or the annexation of Crimea as somehow provoking this forward deployment.
I am in favor of the forward deployment, and I think it's important to keep in mind that even though the focal point for the crisis in the relationship between NATO and Russia, the West and Russia right now is Ukraine, it's a much bigger problem, and it's one that really has to do with how these states that are sort of in between Russia and the West fit into the broader European security landscape. I think it's become pretty clear over the last several years that Russia continues to consider that it has some kind of special regard over a number of these states, and it's expressed through this doctrine of protecting Russian speakers. It's expressed in Russia's position that NATO is not allowed to position forces in these countries, even though they're fully sovereign states. And just this general view that the world is made up of major powers that are truly sovereign, and then smaller countries that have to take the decisions that are made by the big powers for them. And that's a view that I think we in the United States and our European allies are not comfortable with. And as the dynamic between the West and Russia has become more competitive and Russia has sought to undermine the political stability and the pro-Western affiliation not only of Ukraine but of many of these other Eastern European countries through cyber attacks, support for alleged civil society groups, various kinds of pro-Russian movements, support for political parties expressing anti-European or pro-Russian positions, it's become clear that we are in a kind of strategic competition in a lot of this region. And given that the United States and NATO have Article 5 obligations to defend NATO members, including the Baltic states, I think it's quite appropriate to develop the capabilities and the plans to make sure that those commitments are honored, which also serves as a form of deterrence. And so this prepositioning, this increase in exercises, is designed to actually create that capability, which sends a message to Russia, but it also sends a message to these countries, which encourages them to maintain their allegiance to NATO, to maintain their westward orientation, knowing that we will have their back if some kind of crisis happens.
Turning back to you, Will Pomerantz, how has Putin's Russia reacted to this declaration of forward deployment?
Well, it has reacted very negatively, as one would expect. And he has insisted that if NATO increases its presence in Eastern Europe, then Russia will be compelled to raise its presence as well. Putin has to deal with a lot of different issues on various different fronts. Whether he has the military capability to move troops away from Ukraine, if that's one of his decisions in order to deploy them into Eastern Europe, that's a question. But I think it's also a test of NATO as well, because NATO, over the last 20 years, has spent the peace dividend. And by doing so, it has significantly decreased its commitment to military spending, especially in the European nation. So, yes, Putin has responded, as one would have expected, negatively and insists that this is a threat and that, therefore, there has to be a response from Russia, furthering the divide between the two nations. But it also does put pressure on NATO, because NATO really hasn't been spending to upkeep its military capabilities. And therefore, by making this commitment, the European nations are also going to have to back their words with real financial support for NATO and to basically allow NATO to again act as a means of deterrence vis-a-vis Russia. That's very unfortunate because, again, we're sounding like we're back into the Cold War, which is, of course, something that we thought we had gotten beyond. But because of these events, we now have this potential standoff, and NATO can't be perceived as impotent and not willing to respond. It has to do something proactively, and this is what it has decided to do.
Turning to you, Jeffrey Mankoff, for your interpretation of Putin's reaction, and also to the point that Will Pomerantz made about to what extent this is actually stretching NATO. The EU and the United States have been actually drawing down in Eastern Europe over the past decade, concentrating forces in Afghanistan. So this is causing both the United States and EU to have to ramp up militarily, which is certainly a strain on their economies. Discuss that aspect as well, the challenges.
Yeah, no, it's very clearly a challenge, but I think it's also an opportunity. It's a challenge because, as you said, European security hasn't really been the focus of NATO for the past decade or so, as NATO has been engaged in Afghanistan and in Libya and elsewhere. But during that period, there were a lot of existential questions being asked about NATO. Why does NATO exist in the post-Cold War world? What is its mission? What is it that unites these countries? Can we have a common mission objective? And feeding into that was this desire to spend the peace dividend that Will talked about, because if none of the NATO members themselves faced an existential threat apart from their own deteriorating economies, then why does it make sense to have high levels of military spending? I think what's happened over the past year, year and a half, has been to focus minds in a lot of European capitals, especially Eastern European capitals, about threats that exist much closer to home, and that has made the existence of NATO and the continued cohesion of NATO much more of a priority in a way that 10 or 15 years ago may not have been the case. Now, that said, one of the challenges that NATO faces in responding to this challenge is that its member states don't view the challenge in the same light. Obviously, for the Balts, for the Poles and others, this is far and away the biggest security challenge they face, and something that they would like to see NATO and the United States spend a lot more time, energy, and resources on. But of course, there are other security challenges that Europe faces as well. For example, right now, Europe is facing its biggest refugee challenge since the Second World War. And most of those refugees who are coming from the Middle East and North Africa are turning up in places like Greece, Italy, France, the Mediterranean countries. And so for politicians in Paris and Rome and Athens and elsewhere, the threat from Russia is very much secondary, and they would like to see NATO focus more attention and more resources on coping with this massive refugee crisis. So trying to figure out, you know, how to reconcile those different perspectives on the security challenges that NATO faces is going to be a principal challenge that the organization faces, especially because Europe is still in the midst of an economic crisis. Many European NATO members are struggling to meet their commitment to spend 2% of GDP on defense. In fact, only 3 or 4 of NATO's 28 members are actually living up to that commitment. And so in a world of limited resources and competing challenges, it's going to be difficult for NATO as a whole to give the Russian threat the attention and the resources that the people and the states living on the front lines of that conflict think that it needs.
We'll have more on that topic in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are William Pomerantz. He's Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington, and Jeffrey Mankoff, from whom you just heard. He's Deputy Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we're discussing the merits and drawbacks of the U.S. decision to position arms and tanks in 7 European nations, a move meant to reassure NATO allies unnerved by threats seen from Russia. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website, voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and like us on Facebook. And as always, we love to hear from you. Here's a shout out to Nana Yaw from Accra, Ghana. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email with your feedback to encounter@voanews.com or leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, William Pomerantz, to discuss these challenges that Jeffrey Mankoff was talking about, how Russia's aggressive actions in Ukraine and its threatening of the Baltic states have presented another challenge in addition to the migrants, the refugee crisis, on top of the economic crisis. To what extent do you think Moscow has succeeded in playing on the divide that we're seeing in Europe, the divide that reflects some more pro-Russian sentiment versus the anti-Russian sentiment in Europe?
Moscow has tried a divide-and-conquer strategy, and it's not working in the sense that the EU just last week decided to extend the sectoral sanctions for 6 months, and it also decided to extend the Crimea sanctions also for another year. So one of Putin's objectives in this crisis, or one of the ways Putin can actually emerge victorious, would be if he does divide the EU vis-a-vis sanctions, because the sanctions vote require unanimity within the EU. And there were several countries that are clearly on the fence and don't want necessarily to extend the sanctions, Greece being the most obvious one, but also Hungary, Slovakia. Nevertheless, Europe did vote to extend the sanctions. It did so very quietly, but it didn't really seem to have caused a public debate. Therefore, surprisingly, Europe has held together far more than one would have anticipated a year ago. So I don't think his divide-and-conquer strategy is working. We also had this interesting example over the last weekend where the Prime Minister of Greece showed up to the St. Petersburg Economic Forum and was greeted as a hero and gave a, not surprisingly, anti-EU speech. One was, of course, wondering why he was in St. Petersburg and not in Brussels trying to negotiate his own debt crisis vis-a-vis the EU. And even then, what did Russia promise Greece? Nothing, essentially, except the potential of serving as a transit for the Turkish stream of gas that has yet to be built. The only thing that Greece walked away with was a memorandum of understanding. And unfortunately, you can't take that to the bank. So Putin is trying, he's probing, But so far, he really hasn't been able to break the EU.
Jeffrey Mankoff, do you agree that despite his efforts that Putin has yet to actually succeed in, as Will Pomerantz said, divide the EU, that they've held together? What about some of the gaps or the divisions that we see? And, you know, how long can it be sustained, this unity?
In a lot of ways, that's the $64,000 question. I agree that banking on fissures within the EU undermining support for sanctions has been part of the Russian strategy all along. And it's a strategy that's been continually frustrated. I think the Russians have been quite surprised the extent to which the EU has managed to agree first to impose the sanctions and then to extend the sanctions over the course of a number of votes, despite Russian efforts to peel off some of the more discontented members of the EU, like Greece, Hungary, and others. And this campaign is still underway with Russian support, again, for some of these anti-establishment parties, including in Hungary, but also in France, in Greece, in other countries as well as efforts to cut favorable deals on energy with some of the European countries, with campaigns through the Russian media, which is expanding its presence in Europe and elsewhere, both traditional media as well as online. Despite all of that, I think in large part due to Russian overreach and in part due to the leadership, first and foremost, of Chancellor Merkel in Germany, Europe really has done a good job of maintaining a common front despite these Russian efforts to peel off individual members. In some ways, I think the Russians have been their own worst enemy by not following through on the commitments they've made, for example, with the two Minsk ceasefires, which would offer a political cover for the EU to vote to walk back some of the sanctions. But by failing to abide by that agreement, by continuing to make provocative moves both against Ukraine but also around the borders of Europe with airspace violations by Russian aircraft, by probes, you know, by Russian submarines around the borders of a number of EU and NATO member states, I think Moscow is just sending a message to the Europeans that it's becoming increasingly a rogue actor and is making it more difficult for those within the EU who would argue for a more accommodating approach.
Indeed. More on the sanctions. Back to you, Will Pomerantz. EU officials have argued that the banking, technology, and defense industry sanctions have had a significant impact in weakening Russia's economy, helping to push the country into recession alongside this sharp drop in oil price, which, of course, is important for Russia's revenues. And, of course, let's get to the heart of it. These sanctions are meant to persuade Russia to be more cooperative on the Minsk agreement, which we know needs to be implemented in order for the Ukraine crisis to be solved. So to what extent do you think these sanctions have been effective?
Well, it's very hard to judge how effective sanctions are because you have to ask what would have occurred if they weren't in place. And it's speculation. But at several points in this crisis, in many ways, Putin, from a pure military standpoint, has had an open road in Ukraine. In fact, initially after Crimea and just before the Minsk II agreement, when he didn't admit necessarily that Russian troops were involved, but clearly the separatists slash rebels, however you want to describe them, had gained the upper hand militarily. And it was unclear to what extent the rest of the country of Ukraine could resist a direct military incursion by Russia. And they could have created various sorts of reasons for such an action. Both times, Putin has decided not to do so. And one has to ask why. And there are a variety of reasons that don't include sanctions, that he doesn't want to be directly engaged, doesn't want necessarily to govern all of Ukraine. He probably thinks he can't necessarily do so. But part of the reason has been every time he has faced that question, it's quite clear that any reaction would be an increase of sanctions from the United States and the EU. You can't really say that that stopped him. And clearly he was willing to go to a certain extent despite the sanctions. So I don't think you can say that sanctions have deterred Putin from what he sees as his immediate goals. And his immediate goals has been to really destabilize Ukraine. But they have at least made him pause at various times in this crisis when he really had a more open road. And whether you can attribute that to sanctions or not, we won't know till they open up the archives in how many years. Nevertheless, it seems at least it has forced him to consider the consequences of some of his actions.
For your perspective on that, Jeffrey Mankoff, with respect to the effectiveness of these sanctions on Russia, critics are saying that the policy has had no effect in forcing Moscow to reexamine its policies in eastern Ukraine, and that these sanctions are sowing, as we referred to earlier, division between the EU and Ukraine. Mm-hmm.
Again, I think it depends on how you define the objective of the sanctions. If the objective is to force Russia to negotiate an acceptable end to its intervention in Ukraine, then clearly they haven't succeeded, at least not yet. If the objective is to increase the amount of pressure that Russia is operating under, the number of constraints that it faces, both politically and economically, then in that regard, I think they've succeeded. And that may not have direct implications for Russian involvement in Ukraine, but it certainly has implications for Russia's ability to operate in the international system. If we are at a moment where the relationship between the West and Russia, the United States and Russia, is going from one of kind of wary partnership to one that's based on more of a strategic rivalry, then increasing the political and economic pressure under which Russia and the Russian elite and Russian companies have to operate, it puts Moscow in a disadvantageous position, and it forces it to operate in a way under additional pressure, taking advantage of some of the structural weaknesses that are built into the Russian economy, including the dependence on energy, including the rampant corruption. And it represents an obstacle and something that can be increased or decreased depending on how things develop politically in Ukraine and elsewhere. And so if it's going to be more of a feature of the landscape of the relationship between Russia and the West, then I would argue they've been reasonably successful, regardless of whether they have a direct impact on Russian intervention in Ukraine.
All right. Well, that's an interesting perspective. Back to you in the very few minutes we have left. William Pomerantz, these sanctions certainly have severely restricted access of major Russian corporations to Western capital markets, among other punitive measures. So my question is, what about internally? Do you have any sense of opposition to Putin's decisions vis-a-vis Ukraine, his lack of wanting to implement the Minsk agreement? What are you hearing from within, whether it's the oligarchs or other opposition movements?
I think the most important voice inside Russia right now was a voice also at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. And that was essentially saying that if Russia continues it down its current path of having to bear sanctions, of introducing policies of import substitution, where Russia has to produce its own agricultural products, its own electronic products, and so forth, such a policy is simply not sustainable. And you heard that from the former finance minister, Alexei Kudrin. You also heard from other leading previous modernizers who were in the Russian government in the past. And they simply all said that if Russia is going to be able to compete in the 21st century, then it has to engage in structural reforms now. And that Kudrin even called on Putin to call for early elections so that he would have a mandate in order to introduce structural reforms. And one of the things we learned, though, at St. Petersburg is that Mr. Putin is not interested in introducing those reforms. He said that Russia has essentially survived the worst of the economic crisis. He said that the economy was doing better than most people have thought. He continued to argue that Russia was open to foreign investment. He really did not seem to grasp the extent of the economic crisis that is still engulfing Russia. So I think in terms of where we're going, there is still an economic question as to how Russia will compete in the 21st century and how it will modernize.
And the last word to you, Jeffrey Mankoff, mm-hmm. with respect to the toll that these sanctions are taking on the Russian mm-hmm. economy, and to what extent you're hearing voices inside saying, you know, there's only so much we can do. We can retaliate. You know, Russia, of course, has imposed a ban on most agricultural imports now from Europe. That's dealing a blow to farmers in Europe, but also stripping Russian grocery store shelves of some of their favorite imports. I mean, how long can this go on?
I think it can go on for quite a while, but this gets back to the point that I was making earlier, in that the longer it goes on, the more constrained Russia is, the more pressure its economy is operating under. I think over the course of the last couple of decades, the Russian elite and Russians in general have gotten inured to these sharp crises, like what you had in 1998, where there's a sharp drop-off of economic activity followed by a fairly quick recovery. I don't think that's what's going to happen this time. I think what you're seeing instead is more of a gradual but pronounced decline, and it's going to affect standards of living, it's going to affect production, it's going to affect Russia's ability to modernize its economy. And that, in the long term, is probably more damaging to Russia than one of these sharp corrections that you've seen in the past. And it means that Russia becomes less and less competitive, both in economic and in political military terms. And just the other thing I would add is that in addition to the voices like those of Kudrin, you've started to see, for the first time in a while, economically motivated strikes and protests in cities across the Russian Federation. These have been on a relatively relatively small scale so far, and they haven't been overtly political. But if these kind of events, strikes and the like, expand, I mean, they could become a real political problem.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, William Pomerantz, Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and Jeffrey Mankoff, Deputy Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Nick Ivanov. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.